So just to offer a little bit of an explanation, God spoke through people empowered by the Ruach HaKodesh, where they spoke in other languages and tongues. Jerry spoke in a tongue that no one understood, yet what did God do? Provide an interpretation for that. To where I say, this is not a Pentecostal church thing. Yes, it's seen there, but it's not always administered in the way it's supposed to be. Yet I will say this. Before there were Pentecostal Gentiles, there were Pentecostal Jews. Acts 2 tells us that, Stephen. So you have a familiar tongue. A week that transcends time. So what do I mean by a week that transcends time? To transcend means to go beyond the range or the limits of it. A week that goes beyond the limits and constraints of the time by which it occurred. In other words, a week is 7 days and you function within that 7-day period. But in other words, we won't be looking at a week in time consisting of 7 consecutive days, but rather a week in time where prominent historical events occurred within this 7-day period, yet at different times throughout history. Just last week, I shared with you a message in the midst of the Omer, where I shared with you events in Israel's biblical history that occurred during the 50 days beginning just after the Passover on Habikkurim, or first fruits, and commencing with Shavuot 50 days later. These were things that occurred during this 50-day period, so they were in the constraint of this time period. We went from Sinai and Moses to Yeshua after his resurrection. The conduit that connected these two periods in time, separated by approximately 1,400 years, was Shavuot, and the promises associated with this period of time. Shavuot is a time-based moed. It's time-based, or an appointed time, that means you have to determine how you get there. Its occurrence does not fall on a specific date. You can't mark your calendar with a date every year. But we are instructed to count. In this case, 7 Shabbats. Or as is typically stated, 7 weeks. How many days are there in 7 weeks? 49. Then there's a specific instruction that says after 7 Shabbats or 49 days, you do something. Leviticus chapter 23, starting in verse 10. Tell the people of Israel, after you enter the land I am giving you and harvest its ripe crops, you are to bring a sheath of the first fruits of your harvest to the Kohen. He is to wave the sheath before Adonai so that you will be accepted. The Kohen is to wave it on the day after the Shabbat. More about that later. On the day that you wave the sheath, you are to offer a male lamb without defect in its first year as a burnt offering. Its grain offering is to be 1 gallon of fine flour mixed with olive oil, an offering made by fire to Adonai as a fragrant aroma. Its drink offering is to be wine, 1 quart. Does this sound familiar to anyone? We do it every week. Kaddish. Bread and wine. Bread and grape juice. from the day after the day of rest, that is, from the day you bring the sheath for waving, verse 15, you are to count 7 full weeks. Until the day after the 7th week, you are to count 50 days. And then you are to present a new grain offering to Adonai. The new grain offering is the first fruits of the harvest of the wheat. Because the first fruits of the harvest of the first fruits was barley. Then hear this. You must bring bread from your home for waving. Two loaves. One, two. Just so that you're not seeing things. Two loaves made with 1 gallon of fine flour baked with leaven as first fruits for Adonai. Now, keeping in mind we didn't bake this in our home, yet Hannaford is likely our second home. Walmart is our third home because we spend so much time there. You are to bring them as an offering. I'll talk more about this at the end of service when we do it. It is associated with the second seasonal harvest of the land, that being the wheat, as I mentioned earlier. The offering made with fine flour is to be brought from your homes, having been made there and presented to Adonai as the first fruits of the wheat harvest. So this is part of this week. But I'm not starting here, even though, yes, I did start here, but I'm not starting here. The week we are going to explore is the week on the calendar from June 5th through June 11th. Not a Sunday through Shabbat week, but a 7-day period where at times we'll begin on a Sunday and end on a Shabbat, yet not this year. June 5th and June 6th. 2 days that sort of go hand in hand. The first stop, because Jerry asked earlier if you guys want to go on a journey. So I'm taking her words, using them again. Do you want to go on a journey through time? June 5th, 1944. Planning for the operation known as D-Day began in 1943. In the months leading up to the invasion, the Allies conducted a substantial military deception, codenamed Operation Bodyguard, to mislead the Germans as to the date and location of the main Allied landing. The weather on D-Day was far from ideal, and the operation had to be delayed 24 hours. So there was a 24-hour delay. A further postponement would have meant a delay of at least 2 weeks, as the invasion planners had requirements for the phase of the moon, the tides, and the time of day that meant only a few days each month were deemed suitable. Everything is seasonal in terms of tidal movement. The moon is cyclical, 29.5-day cycle. More on that in a little bit. So there was only a fine window that they planned for nearly 6 months beforehand. The amphibious landings were preceded by extensive aerial and naval bombardment and an airborne assault. The landing of 24 U.S., British, and Canadian airborne troops shortly after midnight. Allied infantry and armored divisions began landing on the coast of France at 6:30. The target, 50 miles stretch of the Normandy coast, was divided into 5 sectors, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. Strong winds blew the landing crafts east of their intended positions, particularly in Utah and Omaha. The men landed under heavy fire from gun emplacements overlooking the beaches. So there were enormous casualties. The Allies failed to achieve any of their goals on the first day. And keeping in mind, it was one battalion after another that came in over a period of time. So D-Day was intended for June 5th, but occurred on June 6th. 23 years later, the Six-Day War begins on June 5th. I'll connect these at the end. The Six-Day War, also known as the June War, the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, and the Third Arab-Israeli War, was fought between June 5th and June 10th of 1967 by Israel and the neighboring states of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, as well as Iraq and Lebanon. There were three fronts to the war: Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula, Judea and Samaria, known as the West Bank, which includes Jerusalem, and a name that you probably will be familiar with over the last month, the Golan Heights. Been in the news a lot lately. But rather than go into detail, for which I have provided you the links that you can go into detail and read further, let me share this with you. I've shared it before, but it warrants being shared again. For the simple reason that 10 minutes tells a story that I would need a half hour to go into.
The Muslim nations in the Middle East would not accept Israel's existence since its founding in 1948. They began amassing huge amounts of sophisticated weaponry and lobbying for the implementation of boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against the Jewish state. On the 15th of May, 1967, on Israel's Independence Day, a three-week period began, which was one of the most tense and fearful periods in Israel's history. In direct contravention of international agreements, Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser removed the UN peacekeeping forces and began moving tens of thousands of soldiers and hundreds of tanks into what was the demilitarized Sinai Peninsula towards Israel's southern border. Egypt also blockaded the Straits of Tehran, an open international waterway which was essentially a declaration of war. Israel turned to the nations of the world, primarily to the United States, for assistance against Egyptian aggression, but somehow all Western countries decided to remain neutral. Very quickly it became apparent that the promises were all but forgotten. Israel, with 2.5 million Jews, was left alone to face the might of the Arab nations. Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon formed a military alliance and began moving forces into Jordan towards Israel's borders. When the Arab countries realized that the world had abandoned Israel, many other Muslim countries were openly calling for the destruction of Israel. The will and means to murder millions of Jews were evident. Top IDF commanders expressed their concerns at the high price Israel was liable to pay in a war with the Arab world. Some military experts projected a toll between 20 and 100,000 lives. Israel prepared cemeteries all over the country, ready to accommodate many expected victims. Massive parks were prepared in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and other cities in case the cemeteries would have no more space. World governments, instead of defending Israel's right to exist, warned Israel continuously not to attack. However, the people of Israel had no choice but to go to war, to defend their country and their very existence. at 7:15 a.m. on June 5th, 1967. The IDF launched Operation Moked Focus. Almost the entire Israeli Air Force was dispatched in a daring mission. Only 12 planes stayed behind. The risk of this operation was extraordinary, as the fighter pilots flew at an unprecedented low altitude of less than 20 meters above the ground. Egypt had the most advanced ground-air missile defense systems in the Middle East. Most of the Israeli jets were old and outdated French planes. If the Israeli jets would have been detected, many would have fallen, and Israel would have been left with practically no air force. And then, a miracle occurred. The most advanced Russian MiG jets that patrolled the airspace along the borders between Egypt and Israel were, for that one critical hour, grounded. Incredibly, at that very same time, the top commanders of Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq flew together to observe the Egyptian forces invading Sinai. The Egyptian officers had ordered all anti-aircraft units not to fire unless given a direct order as long as they were in flight. This created total confusion on the Egyptian ground as Israel struck exactly in that window of time. By 7:45 a.m., the high hand of Providence resulted in the Israeli Air Force reaching all the Egyptian airfields without even one plane being detected. More than 200 Egyptian planes, almost half of Egypt's fleets, were almost instantaneously destroyed, also bombing the runways and making impotent the mightiest air force in the Middle East. General Moti Hod, commander of the Air Force, said, "In my wildest dreams, I never would have conceived of such an incredible success." A second wave of Israeli jets were directed to Cairo to confront the remains of the Egyptian Air Force. And here, another miracle occurred, no less miraculous than the first. Even though Israel had lost the element of surprise and the anti-aircraft systems were operating with full capacity, Egypt was only able to hit one Israeli plane. The Israeli Air Force went on to destroy a total of more than 300 Egyptian planes, and every airfield in Egypt was neutralized. It was nothing less than a military miracle, seemingly impossible. And then, another miracle occurred. It was as if God hardened the heart of the Egyptian President Nasser, who continuously gloated about his glorious military victory over Israel. In the Arab media, President Nasser spoke of the end of Israel's air force and of the Egyptian tanks on their way to Jerusalem. Jordan, Syria, and Iraq believed these bombastic statements and wanted to join him in the great victory against the Jews. All the Arab air power struck simultaneously on multiple fronts. In almost any other scenario, Israel would not have been able to respond as quickly as it did. The timing was seemingly orchestrated to position Israeli jets exactly where they should be. Not in 6 days, but in 6 hours, the war was won.
A biblical prophecy comes to pass as the forces of Israel sweep on in an astonishing triumph of strategy.
After achieving air supremacy, her forces thrust like an avenging sword at the very heart of Arab self-confidence.
And then, perhaps, the greatest miracle of all, a miracle Israel never expected, Jerusalem. Again, it seemed as though it was a divine appointment in time. Jerusalem was to be restored to the Jewish people after 2,000 years. The enemies of Israel had twice as many soldiers as we did, three times as many planes, four times as many tanks. The odds were stacked against us on every military front. The love of Israel, self-sacrifice, and courage of the Israeli soldiers, combined with divine guidance and assistance, made these miracles possible. Yitzhak Rabin, then the Minister of Defense, was given the honor of giving the war its name. He chose the Six-Day War, recalling the 6 days of creation, as Israel too was created with the liberation of Jerusalem. As the center of gravity of the Jewish people has now returned to the land of our fathers, the Torah center of the world has once again returned to Jerusalem. The chief rabbinate of the state of Israel has established the 28th of Iyar, a day of Hallel and Hodayah, praise and thanks for the salvation of our people and the liberation and return of our capital, Jerusalem. Jews in Israel and in every country in which they reside come together in prayer and celebration. Similar to Hanukkah and Purim, it sometimes takes many years for the miracles to be fully recognized and celebrated. The Mizrahi World Movement is involved in massive community-wide celebrations across the globe, from London to Los Angeles, from Melbourne to Johannesburg to Chicago and Toronto. For 2,000 years, our hope never died. Our faith as a people never wavered. Wherever Jews were and whenever they prayed facing Jerusalem. Whatever happened the night before, whether it was the Crusades, the Inquisition, Muslim oppression, or Nazis in Germany, the next morning a Jew would wake up, dust himself off, put on his tallit, face Jerusalem, and pray to come home, knowing somehow, some way, God would bring us back. This is our greatest celebration. To be alive in this generation where the prayers of our fathers and mothers have finally been answered, to be alive and to take part in Jewish destiny, to experience miracles of divine providence, bayamim hahem bazman hazeh, like in those days, but in our time.
So as is mentioned in the video, on the calendar, on the Jewish calendar, it was Iyar 28. Today, which is known as Yom Yerushalayim, or Jerusalem Day. It was when, during the Six-Day Wars, that in essence, through the divine hand of God, Jerusalem came back into control of the Jewish people. So let's move on. June 9th, which happens to be tomorrow. This year, it's Shavuot. Yet regardless of the year, Shavuot has always been 50 days after Habikkurim, after first fruits during the time of Passover. I've shared this with you before. I shared it with you in just a few minutes ago in Leviticus chapter 23. The dates seem to change on the calendar, yet they really don't. The apparent discrepancy has to do with two different calendars. Think of it speaking two different languages. You speak one, but somebody else speaks another. Yet neither understands the other, so what do you need? You need some way to reconcile the difference between the two. The Gregorian calendar is sun-based, and its cycle is 365 1/4 days. The Jewish calendar is lunar-based, and its full cycle is 354 days. So you have an 11.25-day discrepancy. So the calendars are different, yet it was the rabbis who created a system that would substantially reconcile the differences. In the 4th century, Hillel II established a fixed calendar based on mathematical and astronomical calculations. Although not 100% reconciled, it is accurate to one day over 300 years. Keeping in mind, this is before Galileo, Copernicus, and the semiconductor. You could input your information into a computer, develop an algorithm to calculate an answer. It was before all that. And they're accurate to one day within 300 years. Over a 300-year period. So this calendar still is in use today. It's standardized. And within this calendar is a 19-year cycle. a 19-year cycle based on the lunar calendar itself, where seven times in 19 years, an additional month is added to handle the discrepancy of the 11 days. The 3rd, the 6th, the 8th, the 11th, the 14th, the 17th, and the 19th year, an additional Adar is added. It's believed that Adar 2 is the original because it's the closest to Passover, and Adar 1 is the one that's added. And yet, you would think counting 50 days would not be complicated or even controversial. Yet it's not the counting that's the issue. It's when you begin that's the issue. So it depends on how you define what Shabbat is or what it means. Two scenarios. And this is during the Passover season. Is it that Shabbat is identified for unleavened bread of the 15th day, which means that the 15th day is the Shabbat that you're referring to, then you start counting on the 16th day. Because keeping in mind, the first day of unleavened bread is considered a Shabbat, a holy convocation, do no work, very dynamics for Shabbat itself. Or do you take the instruction in Leviticus 23 to mean that it is the weekly Shabbat? Keeping in mind, this debate has been going on for centuries, even to this day. The first will always be the same day on the calendar, meaning the first option, where you count 2 days after Passover, the 16th day of the first month. Yet it will be a different day each week, while the second will always be the same day of the week, yet not the same day on the calendar. Have I confused you yet? You start on the 16th, and every month is the same in the number of days. You will always come to the 6th of Sivan. That's when Shavuot is traditionally kept. Yet the 6th of Sivan can be any day of the week. Yet if you start specifically counting the day after Shabbat, day 7, your first count is day 1, and you do the math, 7 times 7 is 49, there's 7 days in a week, so you're going 7 complete weeks, which always brings you back to the first day of the week. Yet the first day of the week will always be the first day of the week, but on the calendar it might be a different day. Have I cleared things up yet? If I haven't, come to me afterwards. So this is one of the many conflicting views between the Pharisees, the Perushim, and the Zidukim, or the Sadducees. Hey, they sound familiar. The Perushim held position 1, counting the day after the Sabbath of unleavened bread. The Zidukim, or the Sadducees, adhered to position 2. They thought it was the weekly Shabbat, and they started counting the first day of the week. Interesting. Because it's associated with the resurrection. And what did the Sadducees not believe in? The resurrection. Irony can be seen in many ways. Interestingly enough, this debate still continues today. Rabbinic Judaism adheres to the same position as the Pharisees. Not really a surprise, since Rabbinic Judaism originated from the Pharisees. Karaite Judaism rejects many of the tenets of Rabbinic Judaism, and they adhere to the second position, garnered from the Zidukim, to begin the Omer count on the day after the weekly Shabbat. So you would think over century, near I say millennia, that there might be some sort of reconciliation or some sort of resolution to an issue. Yet it goes on. So in keeping with the theme of a date that transcends time, Shavuot is one of those days that transcends time. Shavuot connects two moments in time separated by 1,400 years. The parallels between what transpired at Sinai and what occurred during Shavuot after Yeshua's resurrection are numerous. How numerous? Seven numerous. At both, the Torah was delivered to God's people. At Sinai, the Ten Commandments were written on the tablets of stone by the finger of God, Exodus 31:18. When he had finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, Adonai gave him two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone inscribed by the finger of God. And during the Shavuot of Yeshua's time, the Torah was written on tablets of the heart. Jeremiah 31:33. For this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days. I will put my Torah within them and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. You need a second example? Go to Ezekiel 36, starting in verse 26. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit inside you. I will take the stony heart out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit inside you and cause you to live by my laws, respect my rulings, and obey them. So far from replacing or canceling or contradicting the Torah of Moses, the Ruach HaKodesh confirms it to the Messianic believer. Shaul writes this in Romans 3:31. Does it follow that we abolish Torah by this trusting? Heaven forbid, on the contrary, we confirm Torah. Second, both of these events took place on the same day, Shavuot. Third, both were accompanied by many languages, voices, or tongues. Exodus chapter 19, verse 19. As the sound of the shofar grew louder and louder, Moses spoke and God answered him with a voice. And then chapter 20 and verse 1, then God said all these words. You heard some of them today. Paul has shared some with you. Connie shared some with you. There were more after that. And then Acts chapter 2 and verse 4, which Rob read. They were all filled with the Ruach HaKodesh and began to talk different languages as the Spirit enabled them to speak. The fourth connection, both were accompanied by fire. The fire at Sinai was one fire visible by all. The fire in Jerusalem divided itself and rested on each individually. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 18. Mount Sinai was enveloped in smoke because Adonai descended onto it in fire. Its smoke went up like the smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain shook violently. Acts chapter 2 and verse 3. Then they saw what looked like tongues of fire, which separated and came to rest on each one of them. The fifth thing, at Sinai, a mixed multitude accompanied the people out of Egypt. Just as the people from many countries were present at Shavuot in Acts 2. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 37, the people of Israel traveled from Ramses to Sukkot. Some 600,000 men on foot, not counting children. A mixed crowd also went up with them, as well as livestock in large numbers, both flocks and herds. So here you have both Jew and Gentile who traveled together during the Exodus of Egypt. then this is seen in two parts in the New Covenant. The first is Acts chapter 2 and verse 5. Now there were staying in Jerusalem religious Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, a crowd gathered. They were confused because each one heard the believers speaking in his own language. Totally amazed, they asked, "How is this possible? Aren't all these people from the Galilee? How is it that we hear them speaking in our native language? We are Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judah, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and parts of Libya and Cyrene, visitors from Rome, Jews by birth and proselytes, Jews from Crete and from Arabia." That's a Jewish component, both Jew and proselyte. And this would later include anyone who desired or anyone who God invited and they accepted. Acts chapter 15, verse 7. After lengthy debate, Kepha got up and said to them, "Brothers, you yourselves know that a good while back God chose me from among you to be one whose mouth the goyim, the nations, should hear the message of God, of the good news, and come to trust. And God, who knows the heart, bore them witness by giving the Ruach HaKodesh to them just as he did to us." The sixth thing, Torah means to instruct or to teach, and the Holy Spirit is identified as the teacher. John chapter 14, verse 26, "But the Counselor, the Ruach HaKodesh, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything. That is, he will remind you of everything I have said to you." And then John chapter 15 and verse 26, "When the Counselor comes, when I will send you from the, Father, the Spirit of truth, who keeps going out from the Father, he will testify on my behalf." He's a witness and a teacher to the things that Yeshua had taught them. And then the last thing that connects these two moments in time. It's customary in this Jewish celebration of Shavuot to eat milk foods or foods based from dairy. The Holy Spirit provides the milk of the Word. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 1. "Therefore, rid yourselves of all malice, of all deceit, hypocrisy, and envy, and of all the ways there are spreading against you. And be like newborn babies, thirsty for the pure milk of the Word, so that by it you may grow up into deliverance." So, you're not just eating dairy because it's traditional. There's a new covenant aspect as well. So we move to June 10th. By June 10th, Israel had completed its final offensive in the Golan Heights, and the ceasefire was signed the day after. Israel had seized the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, the west bank of the Jordan, including East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. In other words, Israel grew by a third in size in 6 days. Speaking 3 weeks after the war, as he accepted an honorary degree from Hebrew University, Yitzhak Rabin gave his reasoning behind the success of Israel. "Our airmen who struck the enemy's plane so accurately that no one in the world understands how it was done, and people seek technological explanations or secret weapons or armored troops who beat the enemy even when their equipment was inferior to his, our soldiers in all other branches who overcome our enemies everywhere, despite the latter's superior numbers and fortifications, All these revealed not only coolness and courage in the battle, but an understanding that only their personal stand against the greatest dangers would achieve victory for their country and for their families, and that if victory was not theirs, the alternative was annihilation. In other words, how do I put this? Losing was not an option. In recognition of his contributions, Rabin was given the honor of naming the war for the Israelis. And from the suggestions posted, including the war of daring, the war of salvation, the war of the sons of light, he chose the least ostentatious, the Six-Day War, evoking the days of creation. Even though Yitzhak Rabin conveyed much of what transpired, given the heart of the individuals who were fighting, it was not lost on him that God's hand was in this. Just as his outstretched arm was there during the Exodus, it was there here as well. So these 7 days connected numerically in that they are sequential in nature and comprise a period of time that represents a 7-day week. A period of time identified by Adonai at creation and has been followed first by Israel and today is foundational. We don't have an 8-day or 10-day week. I was listening to a program this past week where they were talking about the metric system, a system I am all too familiar with growing up in Canada. One thing I didn't know or was not familiar with about the origins is because everything is based on a measure of 10. The byproduct of the French Revolution, the creators also supported a 10-day week. Try putting that into your calendars and seeing how it works. Yet even the cycle of the moon and the cycle of the sun function in 7-day cycles. And yet these 7 days, June 5th through June 11th, are connected even in even greater ways. All of these moments I've shared with you are intimately connected. Had one of these events not transpired, none of them would. Had Adonai not appeared to Israel at Sinai, there would be no land, no new covenant, no Shavuot, no nothing. This is obviously the first domino. There would be no Yom Yerushalayim if there was no D-Day. If D-Day neither happened nor wasn't successful, Europe would look entirely different. The Treaty of the First World War would be set aside and the San Remo Accord would be moot because Germany would have continued with what was called the final solution, whereby there would be more than 6 million Jews killed by Germany. The Holocaust wouldn't be called the Holocaust because ultimately they would eventually reach their goal of full annihilation. It would still be called the final solution. And then you have the aspect that Germany would control all of Europe and in likelihood portions of Africa, the Middle East, and probably beyond. Because that's the direction they were moving. They were moving south. They were moving east. They were moving north. And they were moving west. Because of D-Day, a turning point in the war in Europe, this led to the defeat of the Axis powers led by Germany, ultimately leading to the Jewish people declaring their independence on May 14th, 1948. Which led to the recapture of Jerusalem on June 7th, 1967, as part of the Six-Day War. Moments separated in time, yet ultimately connected as part of a nice promise. And we can go all the way to Deuteronomy chapter 30 for this promise. It occurs after Shavuot, comprised in Torah itself. Chapter 30, verse 1, when the time arrives that all these things have come upon you, both the blessings and the curse, which I have presented to you, and you are there among the nations. In other words, God gave Israel extensive warning about following him. If you follow me, you will be blessed. If you do not follow me, there will be curses. The further you move away from me, the worse the curses get. So when the time comes, when all these curses have come upon you, at last you will start thinking about what has happened to you. And you will return to Adonai your God and pay attention to what he has said, which will be exactly what I am ordering you to do today. You and your children, with all your heart and all your being. At that point, Adonai your God will reverse your exile and show you mercy. He will return and gather you from all the peoples to which Adonai your God has scattered you. If one of yours was scattered to the far end of the sky, Adonai your God will gather you even from there. He will go there and get you. Haven't even gotten to verses 5 and 6 yet. But God knows where his people are. And God calls them back to the land. These are known as Aliyah, which means going up. It's not just a portion that you read of Scripture. And then verse 5, Adonai your God will bring you back into the land your ancestors possessed, and you will possess it. He didn't say, well, I'll bring you back in to a portion of the land. We won't worry about the Golan Heights. We won't worry about Gaza. We won't worry about Judea and Samaria, known as the West Bank. But you'll possess the other portions of the land. He says the land. Period. You will possess it. He will make you prosper there. And you will become even more numerous than your ancestors. He will make you prosper. Even though Israel is greatly hated, Israel is the envy of many nations. They are self-sufficient. They made a desert bloom. But they didn't do it on their own because they are attached to God, who attached them to the land. So the nutrients and the flow of living water, so to speak, caused the desert to bloom. So there's a promise to bring them back into the land. Yet it was dormant, silent, for nearly 2,000 years. The 1948 occurs after the greatest tragedy in Israeli history, the Holocaust. 6 million Jews out of approximately 16 million at the time worldwide. 6 million Jews out of 9 million, 8 to 9 million in Europe. Imagine this. 2/3 of the American population is wiped away off the face of the earth. Approximately 210 million people. That is the ratio that occurred within the Jewish people during 1933 to 1945. Call it a plague if you will, but it was most certainly not a plague that came from contaminated food, but it came from contaminated people. So in order to fulfill the second part, you must fulfill the first part. What's the second part? Then Adonai, your God, will circumcise your hearts and the hearts of your children so that you will love Adonai, your God, with all your heart and with all your being, and thus you will live. What does this sound like? Sounds like the new covenant, doesn't it? You're keeping in mind, we think, okay, God compartmentalizes things. He's got one task first. Bring them all into the land. Then he'll take care and circumcise their hearts. I talked about God being progressive, even though progressive is a nasty word in today's culture. God brings them into the land, and whoever seeks him will find him. We see this today, both in the land and outside of the land. So keeping in mind, this week, the 7 days, goes beyond just any week within a time on a calendar. But the events that occurred within this week had to occur in order for the events in the future to take place. So this is what I mean when I say that a week that transcends time. So if everybody will please rise.